with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a memorial is scheduled tonight in remembrance of James Chassie Jr., killed last month by Portland police. Dick Cheney and George Bush appear confused on the issue of acceptable methods of torture. Taliban attacks in Afghanistan are becoming less lethal to civilians than U.S. military attacks.
And the human cost of occupation in Iraq? As of today, there have been 2,809 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports 49,697 civilians have been reported killed by the military intervention in Iraq. A new report by The Lancet places the civilian death count at more than 650,000 dead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 27th, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Raul Semprebon.
Friends, family, and concerned community members will gather to remember James Chassie Jr. at 7 p.m. at Portland's First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue. The memorial vigil is called Love One Another. Chassie died in Portland police custody on September 17th. People attending the vigil are asked to honor the family's wishes for a respectful event. Messages to be communicated apart from memories of James will focus on simple, positive phrases such as justice, love, and remember James Chassie Jr. Speakers will include family members, friends, clergy, and community leaders. The family has asked that donations in memory of James be made to Operation Night Watch or the National Alliance on Mental Illness. For more information, call Portland Cop Watch, 503-236-3065.
Pacific Corp has notified regulators that it is cutting its construction plans for coal plants in half. Activist groups, including the Oregon Citizens Utility Board, Northwest Energy Coalition, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, Renewable Northwest Project, and the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, have put pressures on Pacific Corp to scrap its plans to build four coal plants. The coalition says it couldn't support the amended offer because Pacific Corp's continued reliance on old-fashioned plants that are harmful to the environment. The Oregon Department of Energy and the staff of the Oregon Public Utility Commission also object to the company's reliance on coal plant proposals that fail to anticipate newer, cleaner technologies. The commission has until the end of the year to decide whether to support Pacific Corp's amended proposal. Pacific Corp serves 1.6 million customers in six states, largely in Utah and Oregon.
Beginning in November, Oregon newborns will automatically be screened for cystic fibrosis, state health officials said today. Cystic fibrosis is a life-threatening genetic lung disorder that affects about 15 Oregon newborns a year. Michael Skeels, director of Oregon's Public Health Laboratory, said about 80 to 85% of the children go undiagnosed for months or years. The condition causes a thick, sticky fluid to build up in the lungs and pancreas. It can cause respiratory infections and other problems that worsen with time. It can also lead to malnutrition and growth problems. Oregon is the 17th state to require the test for newborns. Screening is scheduled to begin Wednesday.
A trial is scheduled to begin Monday in Olympia, Washington, in which a dozen school districts are suing the state over special education funding. The districts say the state has failed to fully fund classes for special education students. The lawsuit was filed 2 years ago, and more than 70 districts have filed friend of the court briefs with Thurston County Superior Court. The dozen districts in the School District Alliance are Bellingham, Bethel, Burlington Edison, Everett, Federal Way, Issaquah, Lake Washington in Kirkland, Mercer Island, North Shore, which is in Bothell Woodinville, Puyallup, Riverside, which is in Chatteroy, and Spokane.
Federal Way High School in Washington has expelled one student today who was recognized by teachers watching a news report about a shooting outside the school. Spokeswoman Diane Turner says the student was expelled for being involved in a dangerous situation. Police spokeswoman Stacy Flores says shots were fired yesterday during a confrontation in a parking lot between two groups of teenagers, allegedly 12 to 15 Latinos and 12 to 15 African Americans. It happened about 6:30 in the evening as parents and teachers were holding conferences at the school, which was locked down during the incident. Extra police are at the school today because the gunman remains at large. Because of the tension, a football game that had been scheduled tonight has been rescheduled to noon tomorrow.
The Bush administration has considered proposals that would make it harder for legal immigrants to gain U.S. citizenship. Yanmei Xie has the story in Washington, D.C.
The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, a division of the Homeland Security Department, is drafting the new requirements. The proposals would increase application fees from $400 to nearly $800. Benita Jin is a staff attorney at the Immigrants Defense Project. She says such requirements alone can put citizenship out of reach for many immigrants.
I mean, already so many people in the country are struggling just to make their ends meet day to day, to provide food for their families, to provide rent. And many immigrants also in the same situation just are simply not going to have that $800, $1,000 to shell out.
The USCIS spokesperson Chris Bentley says higher fees are necessary to cover the cost of the agency to process citizenship applications. The agency is also redesigning the naturalization exams, which test immigrants' knowledge of American history and their English skills. Bentley says new exams will focus on testing applicants' understanding of the nation's fundamental principles. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
A federal judge today threw out a lawsuit against the U.S. Air Force that contended evangelical Christian values were being illegally pushed on Air Force Academy cadets. An Academy graduate said he would appeal the decision. The case was brought by honors graduate Mikey Weinstein and other Air Force Academy graduates. They contended a military chaplain violated their religious freedom rights by urging cadets to attend Christian services or face being, quote, burned in the fires of hell. That incident reflected a broader policy the group charged of efforts to evangelize Air Force staff. But the judge, in a 16-page decision, said the graduates could not claim their First Amendment rights were violated since they no longer attended the academy.
Republican Senator John McCain is again calling for an infusion of more troops for Iraq. McCain told reporters covering a GOP campaign event in Lancaster, New Hampshire today that the U.S. should send another 20,000 troops. And to do that, he recommends expanding the standing army and the Marine Corps. That's something the Bush administration has been reluctant to do. McCain, who's considering another presidential bid, has been campaigning on behalf of Republican candidates in next month's elections. Last week in Iowa, McCain said more combat troops are needed in Iraq to deal with what he said is a classic insurgency.
NATO Secretary General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer spoke with President Bush today in an Oval Office meeting that focused on efforts to stem this year's surge in Taliban attacks in Afghanistan. Afghan officials say that dozens of civilians were killed this week in a NATO military strike against suspected Taliban insurgents. The NATO chief defended the mission in Afghanistan. The civilian death toll is estimated by Afghan officials at between 30 and 85, including many women and children. It's among the highest in foreign military action in the region since the fall of the Taliban in 2001. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has repeatedly condemned civilian deaths caused by Western forces. A week ago, 9 villagers were killed during another NATO operation in Kandahar.
President Bush said today the United States does not torture prisoners. His comments came after Vice President Dick Cheney embraced the suggestion that a dunk in the water might be useful to get terrorist suspects to talk. Human rights groups complained that Cheney's words amounted to an endorsement of a torture technique known as waterboarding, in which the victim believes he is about to drown. The White House insisted Cheney was not talking about waterboarding, but would not explain what he meant. The administration has repeatedly refused to say which techniques it believes are permitted under a new law. A new army manual released last month bans torture and degrading treatment of prisoners, explicitly barring waterboarding.
A federal judge sentenced a former Bush administration official to 18 months in prison in the Jack Abramoff lobbying case. But first, the judge delivered a 30-minute eulogy for good government in Washington. U.S. District Judge Paul L. Friedman said, quote, There was a time when people came to Washington because they thought government could be helpful to people. David Safavian, the former chief of staff for the General Services Administration, was sentenced on obstruction and concealment charges for lying to investigators about his relationship with Abramoff. Safavian wept in court as he asked for leniency. Also implicated in the case is Ohio Republican Representative Bob Ney, who pleaded guilty to taking expensive gifts and trips from Abramoff in return for official favors. Two former aides to Tom DeLay, the former House Majority Leader, have also pleaded guilty, as has Ney's former chief of staff. And Roger Stilwell, a former Interior Department official, pleaded guilty in August to a misdemeanor charge for not reporting tickets he received from Abramoff.
The current time is 5:11. And now, highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What's the matter with CEOs? Why is it that they brutally fire so many loyal and productive workers, willfully pollute our air and water, cruelly yank away the pension and health benefits earned by their retirees, and generally behave like ruthless bullies? Well, at last, the dark truth about CEOs is coming out. Almost all of them were spanked when they were children. USA Today and others have recently surveyed some CEOs, and yep, as kids, all had felt the sting of the belt, the switch, the slap, or whatever. For example, GE's infamous tough guy CEO, Jack Welch, notes that his mama used to whap him with a shoe. Some of these honchos assert that getting a regular whacking has been good for them, making them disciplined, detailed, and driven. Of course, a less positive spin would describe these same attributes as authoritarian, obsessive, and relentless. All characteristics of those at the top of today's powerhouse corporations. Joe Maglia, for example, the top dog at TD Ameritrade, says that his parents' frequent swattings taught him that, quote, tough love is better than soft love. A lesson that he says he applies to the Ameritrade employees. You appreciate good weather days when you get rain, Joe barks. Yeah, Joe, we'll remember that lovely little aphorism the next time our jobs get downsized or offshored. On a brighter note, Sarah Blakely is a CEO who converted her spanking experience into a successful business. She says she was spanked so often that she soon learned to wear 5 pairs of undies at the same time to cushion the blow. Now, Sarah runs a women's underwear company, giving it the apt name of Spanx. This is Jim Hightower saying, maybe I should be spanked for saying this, but I suspect the CEO ruthlessness has a whole lot more to do with corporate greed than with anything their parents did to them.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Feminist News and Public Affairs with Bread and Roses following this newscast. At 7, it's Jay's Place with J.J. Johnson. The weather is going to be cloudy with some sun today in the valley and the gorge, and sunny and clear tomorrow. You're listening to the KABU Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Members of the Newspaper Guild of Greater Philadelphia have voted overwhelmingly to authorize a strike against the new owner of the city's two biggest newspapers. A local investment group bought the two dailies, their website, and sister properties from Sacramento-based McClatchy in June in a deal valued at $562 million. An estimated 500 of the union's 1,000 members who work for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News attended a guild meeting yesterday where leaders talked about how little progress has been made in negotiations. Only 4 union members at the meeting voted against the strike. The current contract expires at midnight Tuesday.
Across the nation at all levels of government, third-party candidates are running for office. You don't hear much about them, though. America's two-party system poses serious challenges to the candidates who try to work outside it. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Green Party candidate for the Maryland U.S. Senate seat, Kevin Zeese, has no faith in the Democratic Party. We're not going to get what we want as progressives if we only support a Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, if you look at OpenSecrets.org, they are funded by the Israeli lobby, by the pharmaceuticals, by the military-industrial complex, by the health insurance industry.
He's against the war in Iraq, believes income below $100,000 should not be taxed, and says he has the support of not only the Green, but also the Libertarian and Populist parties. But he's far behind in the polls against his major party challengers, Republican Michael Steele and Democrat Ben Cardin. Z says his biggest hindrance this election is an uninterested media.
It's become clearer and clearer to me how the media, the corporate-controlled media, is really part of the corporate political duopoly. We've had two debates, the Urban League debate and the Channel 8 debate, and yet when you look at the Washington Post, they actually crop me out of the picture and headline it Cardin versus Steele and don't mention me at all.
Lack of media attention is not the only obstacle for third-party candidates. In Pennsylvania, strict ballot restrictions are keeping Green Party challenger for Senate Carl Romanelli off the ballot. He had to receive nearly 70,000 signatures compared to the 2,000 his Democratic or Republican candidates needed. And in Florida, Reform Party candidate for governor Max Lynn was restricted from a televised debate. An appeals court ruled hours before the debate that under the First Amendment, broadcasters could restrict participation if it's deemed reasonable. The Florida broadcaster said Lynn needed 10% of the popular vote. Max Lynn says corporate sponsorship of the debates prevailed.
You really should question the democratic process not being democratic anymore. It's ruled by big business and big money.
Third-party candidates are often called spoilers, candidates who some argue cause a loss for a top contender by receiving some of their votes. The most recent spoiler was Ralph Nader, who some would argue spoiled the election for Al Gore in 2000. Professor Sandy Mazel is the director of the Goldfarb Center for Colby College in Waterville, Maine. He says third-party candidates need to have a unique set of circumstances to be successful.
But the third-party candidate has to be well-known. There has to be a split between the Democrats and the Republicans, which is reflected in the electorate. And the third-party candidate has to have a lot of money in order to win the campaign.
Incumbent Senator Joe Lieberman from Connecticut is the most known third-party candidate this election cycle. After losing the Democratic primary to Ned Lamont, Lieberman switched his affiliation to independent and is leading the polls. Kinky Friedman is running an ambitious race for governor in Texas as an independent. He received 160,000 signatures to get on the Texas ballot, and he's virtually tied for second place in the polls. If he wins, it would be the first time in 150 years an independent governed Texas. He says if he does win, all the special interests and lobbyists will be kicked out of Austin.
The Crips and the Bloods, the Republicans and the Democrats, as I call them, they're not only corrupt and desperate, but they're arrogant. And they think that they own the votes. They don't understand that these votes have to be earned. These votes belong to the people. They don't belong to them.
But despite barriers third-party candidates battle, many do win on the local or state level. At the national level, success is not always measured in winning.
We plan on winning all of them. I don't know if that's going to happen, but we run to win.
Scott McLarty is spokesperson with the Green Party.
What we will accomplish is we'll show a strong show of support for the Green Party. The Green Party will achieve ballot access in new states, and the voters, by voting Green so much, will show that the Democrats or Republicans cannot take voters' votes for granted.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The city of Las Vegas is appealing the ruling by a local judge who found that a law against giving food to homeless people at city parks is unconstitutional. The American Civil Liberties Union, meanwhile, says the ruling shows the ordinance is unjust and that it supports the ACLU position in a federal lawsuit. In that lawsuit, a municipal court judge threw out a case of a California man who was given a misdemeanor summons under the city law passed in July. The judge says the ordinance is vague and denies people equal protection of the law. The Las Vegas City Attorney's Office filed an appeal yesterday. Now the ACLU is seeking a court order banning the city from enforcing the law until a federal case is decided.
1 year ago today, teenagers Zed Benna and Buna Traor were electrocuted after climbing into an electrical substation in a Paris suburb in what locals say was an attempt to hide from police. The deaths set the immigrant-filled French suburbs ablaze. In 3 weeks, rioters burned schools, gymnasiums, libraries, public offices, and nearly 10,000 cars. Police arrested almost 3,000 people. 1 year later, French authorities near the anniversary, or rather they fear the anniversary could trigger another outbreak. Raphael Croft reports from Paris.
La question donc maintenant est de savoir si cet épisode-là...
Do you believe the riots last year contributed to better life in the suburbs? Asked the teacher to his high school pupils in the towns of Épinay-sur-Seine near Paris. I think life has worsened, says one of them. Our case has been aggravated by our violent behavior. We should have expressed our voice differently, says another. How can you say that, retorts Yassine. Even when we burn cars, nothing changes, he adds. Anniversary of the riots is at the top of the headlines in the medias in France. Many observers fear it will trigger another wave of violence. Jean-Pierre Dubois is the president of the French Human Rights League.
There is a kind of vicious cycle. The problem is when these young people come to violence, most of the time it's just that they want to be heard, and they feel that if they don't do that, if they don't act with very spectacular images and consequences, nobody will pay attention to them. That's what we would like people to change, because otherwise these commemorations could lead to other violence and, of course, to other political instrumentation of that.
Most in France convinced to say the civil unrest that broke up last year was the result of 30 years of high unemployment rates, racial discrimination in areas abandoned by the French authorities. As Manuel Valls, the socialist mayor of Évry in the south of Paris, says, it will take years to reverse the trend.
Il y a une prise de conscience des pouvoirs publics, on a rétabli des crédits aux associations, on fait plus notamment...
Authorities are now aware of the situation. Funding to local NGOs have been restored. More has been made for education. I see more and more young voters registering. In the meantime, all the factors that led to territorial, social and ethnic segregation remains in many neighborhoods. This continues to cause damage. As long as no deep reforms are made on issues like housing, economics and education, we will remain sitting on a powder keg. What happened last year can restart at any time.
A security services report leaked to a French newspaper this week said that the conditions that led to last year's riots were still in place. Samir Mihi is a member of Assez le Feu, Fire is Enough NGO near Paris.
On a le même climat, rien n'a vraiment changé. Les relations entre les jeunes et la police, ça n'a fait que se dégrader.
The atmosphere remains the same. Relations between the policemen and the youth hasn't stopped degrading. We are trying to tell them they should thumb their nose at some politicians and other media outlets who are expecting things to degenerate. We are asking them to calm down, but it depends on them. At this very moment, we cannot know what will happen in the next days.
Several buses were burnt in the last days near Paris, but according to authorities, incidents were isolated and conducted by small organized groups. Separately, bus routes in the Essonne area south of Paris were suspended because of fears of attack. In this atmosphere, law and order have become major issues with presidential elections due next year. Candidates from the two biggest parties have promised a tough approach to crime. Jean-Pierre Dubois is the president of the French Human Rights League.
The objective consequences of these riots and of this kind of issue is very important, because I'm afraid that the next presidential election will take the issue of insecurity at the center of the political debate, exactly like it was 5 years ago, and maybe it could be worse, because it could be at the same time insecurity and migration problems. And the association of the two issues is typically an extreme right-wing issue.
After April 21st, 2002, that saw extreme right-wing candidate Jean-Marie Le Pen elected at the second round of the presidential election, after May 29th, 2005, when the European Constitutional Treaty was massively rejected by French voters, French have a new date to commemorate that adds to the gloomy social and economical climate the country experiences. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Paris.
In Oaxaca City, Mexico, members of the popular movement are blockading major streets throughout the day as another battle takes place over the city's airwaves. Shannon Young reports.
This is the sound of the entire FM dial in Oaxaca City.
Hablaba para invitar a todos los compañeros.
Not one station is broadcasting on the FM dial with the exception of 99.1, a pirate station calling itself Radio Ciudadana, or Citizen Radio. It first appeared Wednesday evening. By yesterday morning, every commercial station in Oaxaca City had gone off the air without explanation. Although the hosts on 99.1 FM don't openly say they are affiliated with the PRI or the state government, their line is clear. The ongoing protests pose the largest challenge to the PRI's uninterrupted 77-year hold on power in Oaxaca. And the PRI seems to be fighting back over the airwaves from an undisclosed location using a format that's a mix of hate radio with Mexican popular music. Here's what's on the AM dial. 1460 AM has been looping heavy metal for the past 2 weeks. It used to repeat the signal of La Ley 710 AM, a station that Apple members occupied on August 21st. Earlier this month, interfering signals overpowered the broadcasts of both 710 and 1460 AM. The Apple members formally handed over La Ley's station and antenna yesterday because their signal had become totally inaudible over the noise of interference. The other station on the AM dial, although not in the mornings, is Radio Universidad. It just came back on the air on October 15th, after an infiltrator destroyed its former transmitter in August. The university station has been held by dissident students since June 14th, the day of the failed police attempt to take control of the city center from striking teachers. The appearance of the pro-government station less than 48 hours ago has added an extra dimension to the conflict, that of a media war. In between music, the host of 99.1 FM has been calling for groups to assemble today to dismantle the barricades that are up in different parts of the city. There have been reports of shots fired in different parts of the city today, including near Radio Universidad. The station's hosts say that a man who was at a barricade near the state university has been kidnapped by plainclothes men armed with assault rifles.
We need to be careful about these acts of aggression that are being carried out in broad daylight. How is it possible that at 9:30 in the morning they are shooting? In broad daylight, these men are acting this way.
At deadline, the missing man had reportedly appeared in the women's prison about 20 minutes outside of Oaxaca City. Meanwhile, 21 Oaxacans have been on hunger strike in Mexico City for the past 11 days. The majority of the hunger strikers walked over 300 miles to the nation's capital to try to convince the Senate to impeach Governor Ulises Ruiz. The Senate last week struck down that option of ending the conflict peacefully. The hunger strikers say that as of today, they will radicalize their protest by giving up all liquids except water. In Oaxaca City, I'm Shannon Young with Vladimir Flores for Free Speech Radio News.
A new law in India protecting women against domestic violence is set to empower them in a patriarchal Indian society. Meenu Alex has more.
Officially, there were 150,000 crimes committed against women in India last year, half of which officially there were 150,000 crimes committed against women in India last year, half of which were considered to be domestic violence, such as dowry deaths and cruelty by husbands and family. A new law, the Protection of Women from Domestic Violence Act 2005, is said to change that. Now, all forms of abuse against women at home, including physical, sexual, verbal, emotional, or economic abuse, or the most common marital rape, are outlawed. The law also gives the woman rights over their abuser's assets rather than just penalizing the offenders. Moreover, the law also provides for the appointment of protection officers and private groups to help abused women get medical and legal aid and a safe place to stay. Women's rights campaigners hailed this as a path-breaking step in a male-dominated society like India. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Vinu Alex.
And finally today, Northern California radio listeners are marking the passing of a major Democratic institution. By a vote of 2-1, public radio and TV members at KQED in San Francisco gave up their rights to vote for the public television station's board of directors and influenced the nonprofit's major corporate decisions yesterday. KQED had been one of the last big media institutions where listeners and viewers had a vote in the station's direction. Despite frequent on-air entreaties to vote over the three-week voting period this month, only 15% of KQED's 190,000 members exercised their democratic right. KQED boards passed a resolution to ask members if they wanted to revoke their own voting privileges. It is rare that a nonprofit's membership holds such voting power, and business and media experts say that Thursday's result bucks a current trend towards more corporate transparency. That's the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 27th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log into our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Brian Averill. And I'm Rolf Semprebon.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up tomorrow at 7 o'clock here, the KBOO Morning News.
No, that's Monday, isn't it?
Or rather Monday, yeah. It'll be the KBOO Morning News at 7. At 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. They'll have an open forum. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. The moles undermine institutions of domination, war, imperialism, and government powers enthralled to the very rich. At 10, a special program for the election season. Becca Bartleson will discuss election integrity as it relates to Oregon with members of the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition and others. At 10:30 on Earthwatch, Chris Andre speaks with Dan Seres of Friends of Oregon Living Waters. He will update listeners on some of the recent LNG developments. And at 11, Democracy Now!
That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. And one more special note, the KBOO News needs residents of Southern Washington, the Columbia Gorge, and the Willamette Valley to join our reporting team during a live election night coverage Tuesday, November 7th. Do you have a cell phone? And do you know the important local issues in your community? Volunteer by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203. Thanks for joining us.
Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, four academic studies about the effects of media concentration on media content have been published by the Benton Foundation and the Social Science Research Council. Appropriately, the studies come just as the FCC is holding hearings about consolidation and whether broadcast corporations should be able to have even more broadcast licenses. We'll talk with Benton Foundation President and former FCC Commissioner Gloria Tristani. Also on the show, research earlier this year revealed that TV stations around the country are passing off video news releases produced by PR firms as their own news. The FCC launched an inquiry, but now the industry is pushing back. We'll update that story with one of the authors of the original research, Diane Farsetta of the Center for Media and Democracy. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Interviewed on the October 22nd edition of ABC's This Week, George W. Bush declared, quote, "Listen, we've never been stay the course," close quote. This was not a slip of the tongue, but a White House line, as evidenced by Bush advisor Dan Bartlett's assertion that, quote, "It's never been a stay the course strategy," close quote, on CBS's early show the next day. The trouble is, well, Anyone who's been paying attention knows what the trouble is. Bush and his spokespeople have repeatedly insisted that their Iraq strategy is stay the course. Here's Bush at a December 15, 2003 press conference, for one example. Quote, we will stay the course until the job is done. And the temptation is to try to get the president or somebody to put a timetable on the definition of getting the job done. We're just going to stay the course. Close quote. So, take two. Perhaps realizing that people now have access to what Bush calls the Google, the White House quickly shifted strategies. The new line, announced by Press Secretary Tony Snow on October 23rd, was not that they had never said that stay the course was the strategy, but that they would no longer say that. And the press corps, obedient as usual, swallowed the new line. Even ABC World News Tonight did a report that evening about how the White House was changing its language, but didn't mention that Bush had lied about that language to one of the network's own journalists just the day before. The New York Times did a story on October 24th, Bush abandons phrase, stay the course on Iraq, that referred to the This Week interview without pointing out that the interview contained a glaring falsehood about the very subject of the article. Given the lengths that media have gone to expose and in some cases manufacture examples of double talk by Democratic politicians like Al Gore and John Kerry, the clearly conscious effort to avoid pointing out that Bush had lied is a stark example of partisan media bias going into a crucial election.
Newsweek published some remarkable poll findings recently showing that 51% of Americans support the impeachment of George W. Bush. You wouldn't know that from the usual media talking heads because they aren't talking about it. In fact, you might not even really know it after reading Newsweek itself. So hard does the magazine work to bury and blur the information. Titled, Are the Faithful Losing Faith? You might think the October 21st web exclusive is intended as a somewhat critical look at Team Bush. But it turns out to be a lesson in finding the silver lining. At one point noting that on immigration, 40% of people say they trust the Democrats more, while 34% trust the GOP more, but calling that a good omen for Bush because, quote, 2 weeks ago, the Democrats held a 9-point lead on that issue, close quote. Unsurprising, after that, that what many would call the most interesting finding appears in the very last paragraph of the article. And note how it's presented. After explaining that majorities of the U.S. public support Democratic proposals on things like drug pricing, the minimum wage, and investigating congressional impropriety, Newsweek states, quote, other parts of a potential Democratic agenda receive less support, especially calls to impeach Bush. 47% of Democrats say that should be a top priority, but only 28% of all Americans say it should be. 23% say it should be a lower priority, and nearly half, 44%, say it should not be done, close quote. Well, once you parse that, of course, it says that 51% of Americans support the impeachment of George W. Bush, although some of those people think other things should be done first. The piece notes next that 20% of Republicans support impeachment as either a high or low priority. Now, in a sane media universe, such findings would merit serious examination. Burying them, distorting them almost beyond recognition, unfortunately, seems like par for the course for the U.S. corporate press. For most of whom, impeachment of George Bush, that is a ridiculous fringe idea, and evidently will remain so, no matter how popular it actually is.
Former FCC Chair William Kennard wrote an op-ed for the New York Times on October 21st, dismissing the net neutrality debate as a battle between the extremely wealthy, companies like Google and Amazon, and the merely rich, phone and cable companies, all engaged in expensive lobbying for legislation favorable to their interests. Kennard argues that this focus has kept Congress from dealing with more pressing issues and that net neutrality is really of little interest to the public. What Kennard argues we should be interested in is, well, making him wealthier, ultimately, though he uses more words to get there. If we really want to expand access to broadband, Kennard says, we have to put all providers on a level playing field by recognizing that phone companies are at a serious regulatory disadvantage and by passing legislation that would streamline the franchising process. If that's cloudy to you, things clear up a bit in the next sentence as somewhat vague disclosure that, quote, some companies in which I invest at the Carlyle Group could also benefit from the wave of investment that would result from such legislation, close quote. Times readers might have appreciated the more concrete information that Kennard is on the boards of Sprint, Nextel, Hawaiian Telcom, and Insight Communications, companies, surprise, now seeking to profit from eliminating net neutrality. Now everyone knows that it's standard procedure for former bureaucrats to profit from their time in public service by going to work for the industries that they used to regulate. But to present as disinterested experts those who have thus cashed in is preposterous.
While media's conventional wisdom is that good TV means a crossfire-type face-off, some aren't so sure. In an October 20th piece, Jeffrey Zaslow of the Wall Street Journal described the weariness some producers have expressed of the, quote, bickering between the left and right, each parroting talking points emailed from party headquarters, close quote. He points to David Borman, CNN's Washington bureau chief, as someone who's scouring the blogs for, quote, nonpartisans who can articulate the middle ground in an engaging way, close quote. Borman, we're told, says he'd love to find, quote, the great American centrist pundit, close quote. Ah, yes, the elusive American centrist pundit. Well, we'll be happy to give him a hand, and it won't take scouring anything, since Fair has been exhaustively documenting the I'm not a liberal, but I play one on TV phenomenon for more than 15 years, pointing out that the opposition to movement conservatives usually consists of centrists like Mark Shields, Michael Kinsley, Cokie Roberts, David Broder, Susan Estrich, Joe Klein, Alan Combs, just to name a few. Interestingly, the Journal ran an accompanying sidebar profiling 9 B-list pundits now getting TV time. 5 are conservative, 2 are middle-of-the-road reporters, and the other 2 are Democratic strategists. The profile of one of the Democrats gives a taste of her none-too-radical outlook. Quote, women should resist being lured into on-air squabbles, she says. Your voice rises, you sound squeaky, and people take you less seriously, close quote. Well, that's refreshing.
And finally, as a law suspending habeas corpus and authorizing torture goes into effect, the Washington Post David Ignatius has written a column worrying that Democrats might be, quote, profiting from the Democratic base's rage at George W. Bush, close quote, declaring, honestly enough, that, quote, people from the old media like me instinctively prefer a centrist style of civilized debate, close quote. Ignatius praises candidates who campaign on the basis of going to church, getting their hair cut, and, no kidding, posing with puppies. Put off by all the disagreement, Ignatius praises Missouri Republican incumbent Senator Jim Talent for trying to find the center, with ads touting his nonpartisanship. Then Ignatius writes, quote, Talent's move to the center is countered by his opponent, Claire McCaskill, who has highlighted Talent's opposition to stem cell research in poignant ads featuring Missourians with medical problems who might be helped by such research, close quote. Ignatius is actually comparing McCaskill negatively to Talent because she has drawn distinctions between herself and Talent based on actual issues. And just by the way, Ignatius fails to acknowledge that Talent's move to the center is an attempt to distance himself from the flagging fortunes of the White House. But the idea that voters might choose their leaders based on actual issues that genuinely divide the country seems to stir deep concern in Ignatius. Readers should be more concerned that the Washington Post publishes a columnist with such contempt for their intelligence.
Thank you, Steve. You are listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
The Benton Foundation and the Social Science Research Council have just published 4 academic studies exploring the impact of media consolidation on media content. The studies look at everything from local news to music programming to how minority groups are making out as both audience members and owners of media. The package of studies, titled Does Bigger Media Equal Better Media?, comes at an opportune time, just as the FCC is holding public hearings about the wisdom of allowing broadcast giants to own even more station licenses. Joining us now is Gloria Tristani, president of the Benton Foundation and former FCC commissioner. Gloria Tristani, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you.
With the FCC hearings on ownership underway and news that the FCC suppressed earlier studies about the negative effects of concentration, these studies couldn't have been timed much better. Tell us about the four studies.
These studies tell us in different ways that more concentrated markets, whether it's in radio or television or in combinations with newspapers, don't produce better media for the American public. To the contrary, they suggest that in the radio world, in the music format, more concentrated radio markets produce less variety of programming and start to lock out niche markets such as classical, Tejano, reggaeton, bluegrass, and gospel. In the news area, the studies showed that combinations of newspapers and television stations with common ownership did not produce more local news or more local public affairs programming. And the studies also look at the state of minority ownership and how minority populations are served by the broadcast world, and it's pretty abysmal. Only about 3.6% of properties in the broadcast area are licensed to women, and only about 3.4% to minorities as a whole, and that's pretty sad.
Well, I want to get a little more in depth into each of those areas, but you have two studies here done at the University of Michigan. One of the University of Michigan studies looked at the industry claim that newspaper and television cross-ownership has a positive effect on localism. That is, the claim that cross-ownership results in more and better local news coverage. What did the study have to say about that claim?
Well, the study showed that it didn't have a positive or a better effect, that it didn't produce more local news or local affairs programming.
Did it show less?
It showed not less, but that it did as well as other stations that were producing news. But the concern here is that a lot of these combinations were granted because promises were made and the findings were proposed that they would better serve the public interest. You know, if those were the promises, those promises weren't met.
Two of the other studies actually were done at Howard University. In one of the Howard University studies, they looked at the effect of consolidation on minority and women-owned media. What was that effect?
There were two studies from Howard University. One looked specifically at, are minorities and women owning significant amounts of broadcast properties? And the answer is not even significant. It's abysmal. Are growing populations of minorities, and of course women are, I think, over half of the population in the United States, are not owners of broadcast properties. They just simply are shut out. And another finding that the study made was that, or revelation from looking at these FCC data, is that the FCC is not even tracking this well. The state of their data is very sorry and speaks very badly of the way that government is looking at this. So that's kind of the ownership piece. The other pieces are the broadcast properties that are out there serving minority and the growing minority audiences. Based on three ethnographic neighborhoods that were the subjects where the areas where Howard University conducted interviews, the answers were minorities feel that the news is not serving them well, or the stations are serving them well with the news for different reasons. One was that they, you know, certain populations found that there was biased reporting of issues or of particular events if they involve minorities. Specifically, you know, some African Americans commented that if an African American was brutally murdered, that hardly got any attention as compared to white Anglo-Saxon was murdered. And there were two specific instances in Washington this summer that illustrated that. Another showing that was a big concern of across minority populations was that the local news didn't cover the issues that were important to them, such as safety, the lack of affordable housing, and lack of jobs. That, you know, the news concentrated on issues that didn't even touch on their lives. So the gist of these ethnographic, and they were really interviews about how do you feel, people, that the media is serving you, was that the media is not serving us. And I'll make one more point about that study. And that was that for the populations that had radio as the preferred medium to get news, they felt that ethnic radio or a radio that was owned by minority owners was much more accurate and fairer to listen to.
Well, in the last study, the fourth study, I think it was University of Michigan, researchers examined how the concentration of radio station ownership impacts on the diversity of music offered. Over the years, industry officials and some FCC commissioners have argued that concentration does not lead to a lack of diversity. What did the study say?
This study examined particular markets where the big owners had even exceeded what are in place, the caps on how many stations they can have in a market. So they looked at the most concentrated markets. And this study started out with, well, if these are markets where a particular company has nine stations, they're going to have a good variety of formats, more variety than in markets that may have owners that only have four or five stations. The results were the opposite. The more concentrated were these big owners had more stations, they had fewer formats, and that's very, very troubling.
As a former FCC commissioner, you're not new to these debates. What's the upshot of these findings? What do they indicate should be done?
Well, I think what's important about these studies, and I want to commend my employer, Benton, but also the Social Science Research Council, is that the FCC now has, because these studies were filed with the FCC, now has new empirical data that will better inform them as they make these decisions. The FCC, when it made its very flawed decision in 2003 on media ownership, which the courts reversed and sent back to the FCC, you know, has a particular responsibility to get it right this time. And the courts are going to be very, very cognizant of, do they have the correct data? Do they have real justifiable findings to make these decisions? And the findings strongly suggest, the studies that we presented, that if anything, the FCC needs to tighten its ownership rules so that more people have opportunity to own radio stations and television stations, so that that produces a wider variety of voices and viewpoints over the airwaves.
We've been speaking with Benton Foundation President and former FCC Commissioner Gloria Tristani. Gloria Tristani, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
Counterspin listeners may remember the fake news scandal in which dozens of TV stations around the country were found to be using prepackaged video news releases produced by PR firms for corporate or other clients, and not only not disclosing to viewers the source of the material, but often disguising the sponsored content to make it look like their own reporting. It's the sort of thing that industry insiders may know about, but that the general public finds outrageous. And maybe that's why the industry decided to fight back. Earlier this month, a law and lobby firm filed an appeal with the FCC, asking them to stop the investigation of the TV stations, and along with it, they attached a critique of the original research that led to that investigation. That research, a report called Fake TV News, Widespread and Undisclosed, was conducted by the Center for Media and Democracy. They are most definitely responding to the attack on their work, and who exactly is that attack coming from, anyway? Diane Farsetta is the senior researcher at the Center for Media and Democracy. She was co-author of the report. Diane Farsetta joins us now by phone from Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, why don't you remind us briefly of the findings of that initial research on VNRs?
Sure. What we did was, over a 10-month period, we tracked television stations' use of 36 different video news releases, or VNRs. And what we found was that 77 different television stations across the United States had used these. Not once, as you mentioned, was there disclosure to the news viewers about where these spots actually came from or who paid for them. And that has led to a pending FCC investigation of the stations.
Well, what rules were being broken by these stations, if any?
The FCC has on the book sponsorship identification requirements, and that is really the argument right now, is over how these apply to video news releases.
Unlike a lot of research into media that gets done, this actually led to some action. The FCC obviously took it seriously and started its own inquiry.
And because this is the first time that these rules are being applied, that they're being considered in the context of the current media environment and the widespread and undisclosed use of VNRs, the industry is very concerned about the decision that the FCC is going to eventually make.
Well, I said a law and lobby firm, but who is it really who's behind this attack on the investigation and on CMD's research?
There are a few different groups. We have lots of friends in the industry, as you might guess. Unfortunately, the main attack came from not a PR industry group, but from the Radio Television News Directors Association, which you would think might have more respect for independent reporting. RTNDA was the group that had hired the law and lobby firm that put out that smear attack on our report. But since then, the Public Relations Society of America and a new coalition of firms that produce VNRs that are calling themselves the National Association of Broadcast Communicators are also jumping on board.
Well, the RTNDA, if folks don't know, their president is Barbara Cochran. She used to be the vice president at CBS News. She was the vice president of news at NPR. These are news professionals. So let's look at the points that they made in their critique of your research into VNRs. What were their main problems with the research?
A lot of them were saying that we didn't state facts that we did. There were other allegations made that we overstated our results.
A little bit all over the place. Well,
yeah.
Well, one of their top claims was that when considered in the context of the more than 1 million local news stories likely to air, that essentially you're finding these stations, it can't be relevant in the broader context of things.
Right. And that's a frivolous claim. We talk about how what we track, the 36 different video news releases, only represent about 1% of the total number of VNRs that were offered to newsrooms over the 10 months of the study. So we knew that we were only looking at a small slice of the pie, if you will.
And another one of their criticisms says that you didn't acknowledge in your research that a number of these stations actually manipulated the VNRs. They cut some parts out or they added some things. That seems to me to kind of miss the thrust of the point that you were trying to make.
Right. Well, it not only misses the thrust, but it misrepresents, again, our report. We did carefully describe how each television station used these segments, whether they edited them or not, whether they added independently gathered footage or not, you know, whether the TV station presented the VNR in a promotional context or actually, in a very few cases, they actually challenged some of the claims made in the VNR, but we very thoroughly reported that. So they are misrepresenting, and I would say because they don't have stronger arguments to make, they're basically misrepresenting our research and our report. But, you know, also to point out that more than one-third of the time that the TV stations did air the segments that we tracked, they aired them in full, the full prepackaged video news release. And even when there were edits, we found that there were only very minor edits, probably made for time constraint reasons. So I think that this critique from the RTNDA is sort of playing along with this storyline that is put out by the VNR industry that, you know, TV stations rarely use these, and when they do use these, it's only to supplement their own reporting. And what we clearly proved, even just looking at the small sample we did, is that that's not the case.
The RTNDA's point-by-point rebuttal has a kind of scattershot feeling to it, and a number of the claims, as you point out, seem to be based on an uncareful reading of the report itself. I'm looking at their press release, though, where they state what I guess they believe to be the principles at work, and one of those is that the FCC's investigation has had a chilling effect on the dissemination of newsworthy information to the public, and there's a feeling that this is government intervention into newsrooms and that it simply goes against the First Amendment. On that substantive point, what is your response?
First of all, the RTNDA has a history of claiming First Amendment infractions by government when there have been the Fairness Doctrine, when there have come up different labor issues, or basically the RTNDA doesn't want any laws to apply to the broadcast industry. But at the same time, you know, the First Amendment, of course, is something that is important to support and uphold, but trying to challenge the FCC investigation as though it infringed upon First Amendment rights is ridiculous on many different levels. You know, first of all, disclosure is more speech. It's not less speech. You know, second of all, disclosing VNRs is not an attempt to smother VNRs. TV stations can still run them. PR firms can still make them. What we're seeking to avoid is the wholesale deception of news audiences, and that's an important distinction. And lastly, television stations are regulated industries that are benefiting from the free use of the public airwaves. It is the FCC's mandate to be the guardian of those public airwaves. So to say that the FCC cannot conduct an investigation, I mean, it's not even to the point of sanctioning any TV stations, but to say that they cannot conduct an investigation without infringing upon First Amendment rights is just ridiculous.
We've been speaking with Diane Farsetta. She's the senior researcher at the Center for Media and Democracy. You can track this ongoing story about fake news on their website. It's www.prwatch.org. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Music from Iran, Iraq, and Turkey will be performed live at Jammin' for Peace on Saturday, October 28th. Musicians from Iran and Iraq will be joined by Jewish-American musicians, all emphasizing that peace among peoples endures regardless of their government's warring interests. Musicians featured include Iraqi musician and composer Rahim Alhaj, Iranian reed flute performer Hossein Omumi, and Yani Ses, a Seattle-based group of Turkish-American musicians. Jammin' for Peace is happening on Saturday, October 28th, with music from Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and beyond. This all can be found at the First Congressional Church, located at 1126 Southwest Park Avenue in downtown Portland. Tickets are $15 for general admission and $10 for students. KABU is a proud co-sponsor of this event for peace.